Welcome, everybody. It's Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And we're about to have another conversation with two people whose work and lives I respect a great deal. E. Ethelbert Miller, literary activist, poet, board chair of the Institute for Policy Studies. Charles Johnson, retired professor at the University of Washington, noted philosopher and writer, author of Dreamer, and The Middle Passage, and a MacArthur Award winner as well, and all the rest. Join us here to talk about a work they did together called The Words and Wisdom of Charles Johnson. And the first time we did this was before the book came out. And now we're going to take this book in stages. And since we're in the midst of Martin Luther King Day and week and people thinking about that, we're going to focus on those parts of the book. And let me say welcome, Ethelbert Miller and Charles Johnson. Good to have you both with us.
Good.
Thank you
for having us.
So, Ethelbert, let me start with you, because just going back, and how this process started with you and Charles Johnson asking these questions.
Well, you go back to 2011. I think it goes back to a year which we have to look at, social media. This is an outgrowth of a blog turned into a book. I think that's very important. I think if Charles and I were not exchanging emails, regularly, around various matters, this book would not have taken place. I think the fact that Charles was in the Northwest, just in terms of time and distance, made it good for our collaboration in terms of our own personal work habits, me working late, him working late. And then I think also it only comes about because Charles, is retired or had retired at that time. And so he had the body of time to, respond to my questions, because as you can see in this book, Charles did a lot of work in terms of taking every question very seriously and responding in a very good manner.
There's just so much here, and I think that the way these questions came in, and as we talked about the very first time, Charles Johnson, it was you weren't exactly, I would say, that cat brought in kicking and screaming, but there was a little reluctance on your part to do this, wasn't there, at first?
Oh, no, not at all.
No? Okay.
No. Late in 2010, Ethelbert asked me if he could interview me for a year, and I said, well, sure. Because we correspond a lot, via email. I sent him articles about politics and culture and, black history and the rest. And Ethelbert is, as you know, very learned on those subjects, and he would respond, sometimes with a poem, sometimes, with prose. So I said, okay, we'll just continue this in interview form. What I didn't know when we started was what the possibilities were. If you look at the book, my 5 years ago, my response is in January. Yeah, exactly 5 years ago this month. We're kind of brief. He's asking me about Martin Luther King, and I spent 7 years of my life researching King for the book Dreamer. And many years after that, I devoted a third of my life to Martin Luther King. So I would answer kind of quickly and I hope concisely. But then as the month moved forward with other questions he was asking me, I realized, well, I don't have to be brief here. I can open this up. I can do a little research for my, for my answers and responses. I can expand, upon ideas. Now, one of the things I have to say is that this is as close to first draft as I ever get. I mean, my ratio of throwaway to keep can be 20-1, but this is closer to first and second draft. Ethelbert asked me somewhere in the neighborhood of 400 questions.
Right.
And I was able to answer, I think, as fully as I possibly could, 218 of those.
And the ones you answered were incredible, and so fascinating, which is why I want to parse these things out over the coming months and really kind of examine them in some depth with the two of you. And you do begin the book off, these questions off, about King, about your book Dreamer, but also about the philosophy of King, the life of King. And I want to begin there. I think that we've been wrestling on the air on our show with the relevance of King for the 21st century. And some people like to think of King as an anachronism, as this hero that doesn't relate to where we are now. But the complexity...
Can I mention something more before we talk about
King? Sure.
Which is very important in terms of the structure of the book. Before you talk about the King, the actual entry, I think it's very important to note that this book, The Words and Wisdom of Charles Johnson, does not have a table of contents. I think that's very important.
That's interesting.
I also think it also has a very important introduction by Mark Conner, which sort of sets the tone for the book. In fact, when he talks about, you know, this is like a book of many rooms, you know, and you sort of want to dab into it. You know, I think that's very important in terms of how to use this book. So, you know, we may open it up today and we're looking at King because we're looking at 5 years ago. That was one of the first questions I asked him about. And, you know, we're honoring King's birthday today. But if I was using this book, if I just picked it up, it's one you just want to dive into. You want to find a room that, or essay or entry that's comfortable to you. It might be on Buddhism, it might be on, you know, reviewing. But you, that's how I think the book should be used.
Yeah, let me add something to that. You can dip in and out of the book leisurely. You know, you can dip into the third part of it or the middle part of it or the first part of it. And so I think there's a relaxed conversational feel to the essays. But one of the things I should have said earlier is that Ethelbert and I are pretty close in age, maybe 2 years difference. So we have traversed the American landscape as two black males, two baby black baby boomers, in my case, since the late 40s, through the 50s, the 60s. So when we talk about King, we were there, right? And when we talk about any of these figures, they had impact on our lives when we were younger. And so it's a great delight for me to have someone I can talk about who shares the same cultural experience that I have with America, you know, for the last half a century.
Yeah, and then I think also one of the things I liked about what Charles says here about King, and I was mentioning this actually the other day in terms of blogging and also a conversation, it's very important that when we talk about King, look at how King's intellectual development takes place. It's very important to look at King's sermons and not just his speeches. And I think that once you begin to do that, this is where Charles' expertise as a philosopher comes in and provides us with a deeper and much clearer insight into Martin Luther King's thinking.
Well, in Dreamer, which was published in 1998, my hope and my goal was to present and profile King in ways that he normally isn't. That is to say, he was a theologian. He was a philosopher. He was the nation's preacher, you know, during his ministry from Montgomery all the way to Memphis. And, you know, the guy's dead at 39 years old. He didn't even get to be middle age, right? But that is such an intense amount of experience he packs into, you know, one life. But he is first and foremost a theologian, a Baptist minister, and that makes him a philosopher too. And so in Dreamer, I wanted to bring those things out. There's three things I isolate in Dreamer that I think capture King. Three things, three points of emphasis. One is his commitment to agape, that is to say unconditional love is the foundation for the beloved community, which he felt was our goal, not integrating lunch counters, but the beloved community. After agape is integration, is very important for him because our lives are integrated. You know, for a Buddhist, a Buddhist would say our lives are characterized by interconnectedness. Well, King's version of that is, you know, we are already contaminated with each other as Americans and as human beings. And then the final thing for King is nonviolence, not just as a tactic during movements, you know, and demonstrations, but as a way of life. Congressman John Lewis points that out. It was intended to be a way of life. So, you know, I sum it up in three words, those three points. Others first, always.
Charles, could you connect what you just said? And this is the entry in the book from January 17, 2011. Because now we can look at King's sermon, The Three Dimensions of a Complete Life.
That was his favorite sermon, yes.
Right. And could you take us through those three dimensions?
Yeah.
I think it's left, breath, and...
Yeah, I length, breath. Let me take a... What page was that again?
That's on... It's just the entry on January 17, 2011. You know, because what happens is that...
The Many Sermons of Martin Luther King Jr.
Right, because he talks about that level of self-acceptance first, and then service, and then the divine.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, I think this was the speech, the sermon that he gave when he applied for the job at Montgomery. I believe he did that. He also delivered it in London at St. Paul's Cathedral in 1964 when he was on his way to Norway to receive the Nobel Prize. The title is The Three Dimensions of a Complete Life. And in the first one, he emphasizes how we need to develop our personal resources, abilities, intelligence, and talent. It's about doing life's work, quote, so well that the living, the dead, or the unborn couldn't do it better. This is very important. This is our individual responsibility to develop ourselves as much as we can. The second important dimension for King was learning, quote, that there is nothing greater than to do something for others. There's nothing greater than to do something for others. That is our social life. And then thirdly, King felt that, quote, we were made for God, and we will be restless until we find rest in Him. So those are the three directions or three dimensions. One is towards ourselves, what we need to do to transform ourselves to be the best that we can be. Secondly, to serve others always during the course of our life. And thirdly, not to forget that we have to have a spiritual life. That without that, sort of, you know, it doesn't work. You know, his criticism of Marx, Karl Marx, was about Marx's atheism. King was not a materialist. He was an idealist and a spiritualist. And so we have to have all three of those dimensions in order to be full in terms of our lives.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, when let's take this part for a moment since you raised it, Ethelbert. I mean, you quote King in this one piece. You say, we must set out to do a good job, irrespective of race, and do it so well that nobody could do it better. And going on to say, we must work on two fronts. On the one hand, we must continually resist the system of segregation, the system which is basic cause of our lagging standards. On the other hand, we must work constructively to improve the lacking standards, which are the effects of segregation. There must be a rhythm of alteration between attacking the cause and healing the effects. That we talked about.
Those two quotes are extremely important.
Right.
You know, I mean, King is as a philosopher, he's speaking to us in very broad ways about, you know, our being in the world, you know, our existential situation, what we need to do. We have to work on two fronts. Yes, we have to oppose the system of segregation, but then we have to heal the damage done to our people by, you know, the system of segregation. And then, no matter where your station is in life, you could be a janitor, you could be a bus driver, you could be mayor of your city, you have to always strive for the highest standards and do the best job that you can.
You see, Charles, when you say this, and I bring this also back to Mark, because Mark, you're hosting a radio show and you're dealing with communicating to like a community. What we're doing right now on King's legal birthday is looking at him in a way in which we don't look at him. You know, we look at one speech. You know, I have a dream. You're not going to get any. If I'm in a classroom right now, what Charles just said tells me more about how King's life can affect my own than I have a dream speech or me boogieing to Stevie Wonder's happy birthday. I mean, this is the thing where I look at, you know, the importance of Charles's work. You know, just the fact that this is available now for us to go and look at. This is why this book needs to be brought into classroom spaces, okay? Because now what happens, just in terms of this one entry, we have a different way of teaching King and remembering him.
I think it's very important. I think it's extraordinarily important to see the man in his fullness, right? And you're right. This speaks directly to every one of us in terms of our daily lives, the texture of our daily lives, the three dimensions of a speech, you know, of a complete life, because, you know, a particular march is going to end. It's going to end at some point. You know, you're going to get what you need, hopefully, in terms of legislation. Well, what do you do after that? You still have to live. You still have to move forward in your life. What is the foundation, in other words, for political activity? What is the foundation for political activity? It is spiritual practice. So in Dreamer, one of the things I try to emphasize is King's on a tightrope. He's walking a tightrope where he's trying to realize spiritual ideals in the material world. That's really hard to do. At least he had somebody before him who set a precedent, and that's Gandhi, who tried to do the same thing.
But let me ask you a question about this, just in terms of taking this. This is 50 years ago when he gave this sermon, a little bit more than 50 years ago. And I'm thinking about today, and this just to wrestle this one quote just for a minute, and where we are at this moment in terms of what King said. We are at a place where segregation has ended, but that the fundamental nature of how race and racism define society has become the issue to wrestle with at this moment in this society. From Black Lives Matter and more, from Katrina, the election of President Obama, the reaction to Obama. So it's not segregation. In some ways, it's something deeper than segregation at the moment. And B, talking about looking inwards to the community itself, we're also at a time of unprecedented murders and other issues affecting the poorest black communities in America. So those passages, to me, in some ways, Charles Johnson, speak to that.
Well, that's good. Ethelbert, I'm going to let Ethelbert respond to this.
That's fine.
Yeah, I'm going to respond to this, and I respond to this in terms of more, you're looking at 1964, and we live in 2016. If we go back and look at Obama's Philadelphia speech that he talked on race during his campaign, he talks about the difference between him and Reverend Wright. He says a key thing, that Reverend Wright feels that racism is static, okay? Well, we know it isn't, okay? And this is very important that when we go back and look at what King said in 64, we look at 2016, we have to account the fact that, okay, things are going to change in a very complex way. It's, you know, and so you just can't list ideas and just pull them into the future without them, those ideas changing, or the fact that we look at them differently and we apply them differently. Okay. Even King was wrestling around 64 through 64 and 68 in terms of realizing as he breaks down these laws of legal segregation, he's going to be faced with economic issues. Okay. Mm-hmm. Or the fact that now his movement is moving from the South to the North. I mean, I think a key part of King's transition is when he goes out to Watts in 65, you know, and then goes up to Chicago, Cicero. I mean, he's beginning to see a different America. Now, you come out here as a young black boy, in 2016, you see a different America, okay? Does it speak to you? You've got a black president now, but does it speak to you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and these are key questions. When we look at King or any other historical figure, Du Bois, what they do, if they are true leaders who contribute to our tradition, all they present is a blueprint, okay? But if you give a black president a blueprint and they have no carpentry skill, no electricity, what can they do with the blueprint? But look at it, you see?
Well,
and that's the problem right now, that we have given, some of us haven't even looked at the blueprint, which is the problem there, but if you give people blueprints, it means you have to build something, okay? And that requires a certain degree of heavy lifting and faith in what you're trying to build.
Yeah, and I would just tack on to that my feeling right now that we are at a critical moment in the 300-year black liberation struggle. I think this is a critical moment in 2016 for black America and also for America in general. In King's time, we had a different economy. Now we have an information economy, a global knowledge-based economy. We have skills that are very specific for that information economy, STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. This is a different landscape than I have ever seen in my life. And so when I talk to young people, I'm very cautious about trying to tell them my experience and offer that to them as a model for what they can do today. Things are very fluid. Things are very different. And I happen to feel, and I hope this doesn't sound too grim, that what's happening right now is going to determine the situation of black America for the rest of this century. That's how important these questions are that you raise, Mark, you know, about Black Lives Matter and the relationship between black people and the police and our education system and the poor schools. This is a critical moment, and I'm still trying to find my way through it, actually.
Let me just ask this question, Ethelbert, just to throw this out there. Ed, please, and Jen, jump right in. But well, that's one of the reasons I raised this question. Not that things haven't changed. Not that we haven't, that over 50 years, that it is fluid. It's not static. But what I'm saying is the questions he raised here, those two points he raised about segregation, on the one hand, and our lagging standards on the other, the way he put it, that we are in some way, we're wrestling with the same kinds of issues in a totally different framework because we've progressed, but also because of what's erupted here in the last 15 years has changed the nature of our understanding of race and the role that race plays. And at the same time, you're seeing that there are huge portions of the black community that are struggling in some ways more now than ever with a very powerful kind of internal suicidal things going on. You know what I'm saying? I mean, so he's...
That's true, Mark. That's true, Charles. But let's look at something. If we go and we open any book dealing like African-American history and culture, they're going to mention some strength within African-American culture. And they're going to be the same, okay, the strength in terms of the church, black religion, black music, all sorts of things tied into the spirituality of us as a race of people. And if you look at how important Christianity, the black church, was liberation, or how much our music, in terms of the voice writes about this, the spiritual, okay? Look at what was the strength of African-American culture, resiliency, and look at what's happening today. Look at where black music is today, okay? Look at what's happening to the black church. Or the fact now, we're at a key point, and Charles can jump in on this, where all of a sudden, okay, some of us who are really serious say, oh, man, maybe Christianity isn't the answer. I want to look at Islam, Buddhism, or something else. Because what happens when I go to the black church, it doesn't speak to me. Okay? But the institutions that we used to have within the African-American community that we're so proud of and said pulled us through all of these 300-something years, those things have almost deteriorated, or a younger group of generations has not embraced it.
Amen. Okay? I agree with that 100%.
You know, it's very touchy, because what happens is that when you look at our music, people may not want to talk about it. But I tell people, you bring somebody like John Coltrane back to 2016 and play some music for him, he's going to have some problems with his ears. He's going to take his soprano sax and leave. Or who's going to sit in and play with him? Who's he going to jam with?
Well, he might find a lot of hip-hop artists to jam with, I think. I mean, I don't think...
This is very important. Very, very. Let's take Malcolm X, for example. Bring him into the equation. Malcolm X didn't have sex for X number of years. Okay? Keep that. How many people are going to follow that Malcolm X? Okay? Look at the discipline. How some people can't even be disciplined in terms of nonviolence? Okay? So when we look at our leaders, let's look at them very closely. You see? And we say, they're doing that, but it's not on the same level spiritually. Don't tell me you got X number of people following you on Facebook and how many likes you have. That doesn't qualify for spreading to a spiritual way. And we don't want to be critical about that. You know, I'm not writing off a generation. I'm just saying, let's analyze and look at it.
Well, go ahead, Charles. What were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say amen. Ethelbert, he's smoking, man. I mean, he's nailing it. He's spot on. This is the problem. This is the problem that he is articulating. We have to have a vision. And we had a vision in King's era. And that vision drew upon black American culture, as he said, the historic importance of the black American church, as well as the spirituals, as well, you know, as our music. We had a culture that we could stand on as a foundation. And things have radically changed since the 70s and the 80s, so that I feel our young people are lost. They don't know where to turn. In terms of their families even, only 25% of black Americans right now are married. 70% of black kids are growing up in homes with no fathers. Now, I had a dad who was probably the most moral man I've ever known. I admired him. You know, I never wanted to do anything that would make my mom or my dad ashamed. I was a good Confucian son, so to speak. But that sense of the family, you see, that's a foundation, too, because the family is a survival unit. Black people always understood that. You could be rejected out in the world, but you could always go back home to the family where you would be supported, and there would be a meal for you, and there would be a bed for you. And we worked together as black people during the era of segregation because we had no choice. And every group in America that I know about does that, whether we're talking about people who are Jewish, whether we're talking about people who are Asian, you work together. And we have fragmentation now. We compete with each other in ways that are not healthy.
And Charles, when you say that, when I think of my father, I admired my father, but I feared my father. You know, like I tell people, you know, my father was like the Supreme Court, man. Some cases didn't get to him.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like the one person you did not want to have displeased with you was your father. I mean, I told my dad, and I've told other people, the only person I ever felt in my life I had to answer to or be accountable for was my father. Nobody else. Nobody else. If I could satisfy him, then okay, we're cool.
And you know what? Let's turn to a movie. Okay. But you remember if you look at Boys in the Hood, that movie, you know, and I think it's Lawrence Fishburne, I mean, you know, the father of Cuba, all of a sudden that figure in that movie is so important because the other kids didn't have fathers. You see?
Yeah.
And this is, and what happens, what you're talking about, if you look at our young people, okay, and confronting the police, okay, you know what happens? The policemen are just like enough. What happens, you leave your house because there's no father figure or even mother figure in there giving you that sense of discipline and what's right or wrong, okay? You may know the police are wrong, but how do you deal with that, okay? If you have no father or parent to guide you through this complexity.
So yeah. I want to kind of come back to where I started here with this, both in terms of hip-hop and in terms of what you two have raised about the shift. And the quote I was using from the speech that you love, Charles Johnson, that I quoted earlier from The Three Dimensions of a Complete Life. And by the way, we're talking with Charles Johnson and Ethelbert Miller about their work together, The Words and Wisdom of Charles Johnson. We'll be right back. And join me tonight at 7 p.m. at the Enoch Pratt Central Branch as I have a conversation with MSNBC national correspondent Joy Ann Reid about her new book, Fracture, Barack Obama, the Clintons, and the Racial Divide, which explores the history of race relations in the United States and political shifts inside the Democratic Party. Just show up, and you can find more information about this Writers Live event at calendar.prattlibrary.org. This is Mark Steiner here with E. Ethelbert Miller, literary activist, board chairperson, Institute for Policy Studies, one of our great poets, and the philosopher Charles Johnson, and National Book Award winner, one of our leading scholars, wrote The Middle Passage and numerous other books that we've talked to him on the air about. And we're wrestling with the book they put out together called The Words and Wisdom of Charles Johnson, and wrestling with just a piece of the book now, which has to do with Martin Luther King during this week of his birth. Let me come back and just push back a little bit about what we just said. And in terms of King, what I'm positing here is that King, as a philosopher and as a political leader, as a theologian, as a man who believed deeply in the liberation of Black America and of all America, That one passage I read to you earlier, to me, I'm going to come back to where it fits today. Because, yes, it's changed. But I don't think Martin Luther King, if he was 87 years old and alive today, would be sitting there going, just kind of looking at hip-hop as a total degradation of culture, A, or B, he would see that we have one of his last quotes was, you know, where I'm paraphrasing, you know, I didn't know I was integrating us into a burning house.
No, that's not King. That's Malcolm, isn't it?
No, that's King.
That's King?
Yes.
Say the quote again.
I'll find the quote as we're talking. Unless I have it completely wrong, which is very possible. But what I'm saying here is that here it is. This is something King said. This is when he was talking with Harry Belafonte, I believe, in his last conversations between him and Martin Luther King. There's a quote he's saying, "I've come upon something that disturbs me deeply." King speaking. "We have fought hard and long for integration, as I believe we should have, and I know that we will win, but I've come to believe we're integrating into a burning house."
Well, I'm wondering if he's playing off Malcolm, because I remember that from being a teenager. It was something that I thought Malcolm said. It stuck with me my entire life. Why do you want to be integrated into a burning building?
Well, you know what happened? I could see that carefully if it's – I'll have to look at the date. If, for example, we put that around 1965, when King goes out and he confronts the young people in Watts, you know, and he begins to question some things, when he's, you know, being attacked there in Chicago, I think that, you know, and in the conversation, maybe with somebody like Harry Belafonte, who's like, you know, close advisor, you know, I could see that coming out.
But the reason I raise this, because this is something that came out of Harry Belafonte's work. And then Belafonte goes on to say, "The statement took me aback. It was the last thing I would have expected to hear, considering the nature of our struggle, and I asked him what he meant. And the quote then is, 'I'm afraid that America may be losing what moral vision she may have had, and I'm afraid that even as we integrate, we are walking into a place that does not understand that this nation needs to be deeply concerned with the plight of the poor and the disenfranchised. Until we commit ourselves to ensuring that the underclass is given justice and opportunity, we'll continue to perpetuate the anger and violence that tears at the soul of this nation. I fear I'm integrating people into a burning house.'" That was the quote that Belafonte said of King.
And that's very important. But see, when we pull those quotes out, we've got to put dates next to them, because that's a later King. That's a King that now is looking at the Vietnam War. That's a King that's probably looking at, you know, the fact that the economic issues are key. This is like, you know, the poor people's more. I mean, that's a King's later years. You know, and what happens is that, you know, we have to look at whatever date that comes out.
Well, I think if King were alive today, he could say exactly those same words about the situation of America.
Right.
Right now. I mean, that hasn't changed.
That hasn't changed, Charles, but this has a lot to do with whether the glass is half, the old cliche, half full or half empty. I mean, we've looked at some gains that have been very significant within the African culture. We can't ignore that, you know. Even on a symbolic level, you know, King would probably be shocked that, you know, Obama was president of the United States. And this is why I think when we look at Obama's two inauguration speeches, that he gives, he acknowledges, you know, King, because he sees the civil rights movement as being linked to him. And so when we see that, I mean, there's been major changes, you know, very positive changes, you know, that I would not erase between, you know, the last 50 years and say, okay, it doesn't make a difference. It's a significant difference.
No, I would not want to erase them either. I think they need to be acknowledged. Those positive, there is progress. There is indeed progress. It might be incremental. It might be two steps forward and one step back. But there is progress, but we have a very mixed picture. And I think, you know, probably the emphasis on the underclass, as he called it, or the poor, is our sticking point. That is to say, the progress has not been there to the same extent as it has for black people who were able to move into the middle class and also become millionaires.
Yeah, but we could go back and say that was the battle during Reconstruction or during the 30s. I mean the whole thing in terms of the inequality, huge inequalities within the American system. You know, these are really one where you have to say, is capitalism a problem here, you know, today? But, you know, what happens, this country has always had people, a lot of people, who have just been invisible. We didn't have to have a Michael Harrington to realize it was another America, you know? Yeah. And what happens now, the more visible, the more angry, social media is key, and we see the poor people more than ever before. Mm-hmm. And what happens now, we have to respond to it because we have the money. And what happened? We're dealing with just pure greed. pure greed.
So that's what I'm saying is going back to King and what the King's what King has to say to us now in this year of 2016. That's why I raised the issue I raised earlier. That I think we're in a time when, you know, when King spoke, they said 40% of black folks were living in poverty. I think it was deeper than that, as I think it's deeper than that now. And I think that...
Sure, but...
Go ahead. I'm Charles.
Sure, but let's look at what I think the issue here is. Goes back, and let Charles pick up on it. Okay, we're talking like, what would King say this next? If we go back to what our discussion was, King was explaining in 64, women's sermon, what type of life we should be leading. As simple as that. Are we living that life? No, we're not.
No, we're not. And I think those are values that are timeless. They are not tarnished by time. Those
right.
are what human beings have to do, regardless of wherever they are on this planet or whatever century that they live in. You know, that's why he's a philosopher, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I guess what I'm looking at with a great degree of distress is the situation that our young people are facing, you know? As young people, I mean, my daughter is, what, she's 34. And, you know, she and her friends don't know if they'll ever be able to afford a home, you know, as young people. The prices here in Seattle for homes are really pretty bad. We live in the sort of buzzwords that we use, you know, economic inequality and so forth, they do touch upon the problem. But I think we're at a critical stage, as I said earlier, for both America in general and black people, you know, in particular. At the end of his life, King was a socialist, and he told his staff
right.
not to be afraid of that term. You know, he wanted, an economic bill of rights. He wanted guaranteed income for people. He'd gone and seen European socialism and felt that could be applied here. I mean, what Bernie Sanders is talking about is pretty similar to what King was talking about in 68
and 67. But let's look, Charles. Let's look at some role playing. So you, Charles Johnson, are now Frederick Douglass. Okay, you got a little Frederick Douglass look. I like how you hear great. So you're Frederick Douglass, and you're talking to Abraham Lincoln. And what happened, Charles? We've got the newly emancipated, we got the emancipated slaves. You know, what are we going to do with all these black people who are now free, don't have a lot of education? What are we going to do? I think that's just as big as 2016, is it, or less? We're talking about all these. We got all these free black people going back to 1860. Okay, what do we do with them? Send them to Haiti, send them back to Africa. How do we educate them? And our race did what? We began to solve these major issues, and we changed the country.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, let me just grab a hold of that because I was writing to somebody the other day. The situation facing white America with the impending freeing of the slaves, right, was what do you do with these people that you brought over here against their will? I mean, do you let them just be like white people, you know, free white, like free white labor? A vote was taken when the American Colonization Society was formed by black people in Philadelphia. And all their leaders, like Paul Kufi and others, right, were arguing that we should leave this country. They were free blacks in Philadelphia who were voting.
Mm-hmm.
The leaders voted that we should leave, that white people will always try to be dominant, blah, blah, blah. All of the parishioners voted to stay. They all voted to stay. So you've got these people here in 1863 and 1865, and what do you do with them? Well, Liberia was set up as a place to send them to, right? And some black people did, in fact, go there. But where does the answer come for a distressed nation of white people about what do we do with these black people? It comes with Booker T. Washington's Atlanta State Cotton Exhibition speech where he says, well, we can be here and equal but separate like the fingers on a hand. And that's what the South was dying to hear, right? And then what does Booker do? He does what you just said. He sets up schools. The schools he first taught, set up, he was teaching Native Americans as well as black people, you know, and we had a hunger for education and reading. That's what we came out of slavery with. And then Little Tuskegee sprang up all over the South, right?
Right. But even before the Little Tuskegee, you go back. What happened? If you listen to what you said, Charles, you were focusing in terms of, okay, white people, what are they going to do with the black people? But black people themselves were taking it upon themselves, building institutions and solving some of their own problems. Okay?
Yeah.
And what happened? Go back and look at Reconstruction. So how many miles, or the newly emancipated slaves, how many miles did they walk just to get an education? The hunger was there.
Yeah.
See, the hunger was there. When people say, oh, here we have all these immigrants coming into the United States and they're working hard. And what happened to the black men? Don't tell me those stories, because we were working 18, 20 hours, keeping our families together, working eight, nine jobs. We had that. And then what happened? The history of this country, we got trapped in these cities, filled with despair and decay. But don't tell us that we didn't have that.
We had it.
Right?
Yeah,
we
had it.
Right, we had it.
Well,
When you say the person is right. But when you say the person is, so the whole thing about the faith of the black church back then.
Well, see, you and I are old enough to remember that, because we saw that in our parents, our grandparents, and our elders who were born, you know, in the 1920s and at the turn of the century, right, before the First World War. We were masters and maestros of survival. And it was because we knew we had to work together, and we knew we had to keep our eyes on a certain prize, which was education, skill development, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of that's been lost, and I think it's terrible, Ethelbert, that it's been lost. We have to get that spirit back, okay? We have to get that spirit back. We haven't had that spirit since 1965.
Yeah, this is why I tell people, is the key thing now is heavy lifting. You know what has to be done. It requires heavy lifting now.
Going back to where I started this whole conversation that led us to the place we're in now in this conversation, whether it's the quote I read earlier or whether it is when you wrote about the dreamer on page 357 in the Words and Wisdom of Charles Johnson, about in the 1960s, the federal government was preparing for a possibility of a civil war, of a race war, and talking about how the novel opens up. So when you look at that, I mean, what I'm saying here, I guess, is coming back to King and where he might be today, seeing where we are, that all the progress of some black billionaires and things have opened up, and the black middle class has grown but also suffered more than anybody else after the crash of 2007, where the majority of black wealth was lost. That
20%.
Yeah. We are in a very interesting place in terms of race, and that's why I used that earlier.
I think it's a very dangerous place. Right.
I think
now,
it's very dangerous. Right. Extremely dangerous.
Yeah, I think the real danger, I think we're going to see this year. My concern, and I look for as a writer, I'm waiting for the word backlash to become more and more part of our vocabulary. I'm looking at, especially coming from the Republican Party, a systematic attempt to dismantle all the things that Obama did during his 8 years. A systematic attempt, you see, and really dividing this country into, you know, red and blue states. I really see that happening coming in terms of who is elected after Obama, who has to maybe hold on to some of these gains, or you look up and they're trying to reverse them. I'm also looking at all the books that are probably in first draft right now, complaining about what wasn't done or this or that, or the worst, this was the worst president of the United States. You see? And that's why I've been telling people they need to get out here and find airports to name after Obama so his memory is maintained.
I'm going to ask you a question.
All right.
Because I want to see which way you jump on it.
Mm-hmm.
I read once, or I heard from at least one historian, that you look back through history and the Western world, and you see that democracies last about 200 years. We passed that point in the 70s, right? And I think about what happened to an earlier democracy, the Athenians, right? I even wrote a story about this called The Cynic, how that long Peloponnesian War drained Athens, the war against Sparta, and they fell apart. The Athenians fell apart. So much of what they went through is what we're going through right now. People retreated from social life, and they went back to a kind of tribalism, right? There was a kind of cynicism in terms of the sophists in the way that they taught rhetoric so that you could achieve power. There's so many parallels I see between what happened to the ancient Greeks and what's going on right now. So here's my question.
Mm-hmm.
do you think our democracy can endure?
Well, you're out there in the Northwest where people are trying to take part of the country back.
I think that it's going to be very difficult for this democracy to survive. I think our Peloponnesian War is Iraq, is Afghanistan, is ISIS.
Yeah,
that's our Peloponnesian War, and I think that
it's draining
people's lives.
And resources and national treasure.
It's just like when King said that it took $300,000 to kill every Viet Cong, but you only invest $53 in every poor person in America. You know, it's draining us. And I think that you can take that analogy and put it in today's world from when King said that in 67. And I think that we also are more – the complication for this democracy is race. And the complication is that because – the entire system of America, the capitalist system itself, was built on racism and free labor and the wealth it built and the contradictions that ensued. Those things together will, in 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 or 1,000 years, people looking back and saying, this is how America's democracy fell apart. The interaction.
I think we also have to look at Obama as a measuring stick here, because what happened when we look at Obama's inauguration speeches, he is talking about this more perfect union. He sounds like Lincoln. He's drawing upon Lincoln. And what happened? Instead of free and slave states, we're talking about red and blue. We're looking at a whole society right now, in our country, breaking down like it's the 13 colonies again. You know, this whole thing like, okay, I don't have to listen to the federal government. I can stand up and ignore the Supreme Court decision. Get out of here with that. I don't want to be a colony. You know, and what happens now? You got people saying, I'm going to take over the land back here later for the federal government. Where are you living? You know, you didn't want to support the Native American treaties, and now you've got a few people going to take over part of the land. And this balkanization that we see happening in a society that people don't want to respect the federal government.
We don't have
e pluribus unum at all. We do not have out of many one. But the question is, I think, how do we get back to that out of many one?
Very easily. Look at our founding fathers. Look at the genius of our founding fathers. We need to have, you know, people, according to the Benjamin Franklin, they created this, okay, with all the battles that they had to do, the balance, you know, the backs of black people, you know, leaving out women. It's still an experiment. And are we up to the challenge?
Did you say experiment?
It's an experiment. America is still an experiment.
No, that's the way that the founders put it in the 17th
right.
century, 18th century. What we have is an experiment in democracy. And as one of my former editors at the New York Times Book Review put it, most experiments fail. Okay.
at least
scientific ones fail, right? So, I mean, that's what we're looking at. This is an experiment. And I don't know what the result's going to be, how the conclusion is going to be.
I mean, I think that as we close this out and get some closing thoughts from both of you here, as we reflect on this book and where we are with Martin Luther King today and philosophically and practically, that I think there's no – it's not a mistake or an accident that the majority of people in America who elected Barack Obama president did so, in my mind, for one reason. They did it because – people were frustrated with where America's going. They believed that a real hope and change might happen. And that happened, and it was embodied in a black man. For people in a country that was defined by race and racism, that was not a mistake. That was a motivating factor, unconsciously for most, that pursues
today
and pushes us.
Today, polls say that 70% of Americans feel the country's going in a wrong direction.
Well, there's no question about that, but that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying – this is why, and I think part of that reaction is because of the reaction to having, from the other part of America, having a black man in the White House, no matter what his policies were.
Mm-hmm. Right, and this is why when you look at the battle between, like, you know, the federal government and states' rights, it's easier to hate the federal government if it doesn't look like you. You know, the federal government is the other. You know, the federal government has a funny name, you know what I'm saying? I mean, so what happened, that just goes right onto it. I mean, you know, what happens is that, you know, the White House doesn't look white anymore, you know? I mean, so what happens is that it's easy to hate this government.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And this is why, from the time he became president, people yelling at the president, disrespecting the entire office. Even people who are conservative say, you can't go, you don't do that. That opens the door for just destroying our society.
Let me just jump here to say that this has been a very intense conversation. And I just, with both of you, I'd like to start with Ethelbert Miller and close out with Charles Johnson. Just your closing thoughts on what we've come to in this discussion and this part of where King fits into today's world and the last 5 minutes or so that we have. Ethelbert?
Well, I'm going to come back to Charles Johnson because this is Charles Johnson's book. And,
exactly.
And what happens, I think you can see that Charles Johnson, this is why I highly respect him, because he is a writer and a man of ideas, and we need to be discussing ideas, okay? And they're big ideas. Okay, and this is what I like, the fact that, Charles, is a philosopher, and he understands and recognizes other philosophers. Because what happens now, if we cannot think about what the big ideas are, we can't solve the little problem. Not even
well,
the little problem.
I would say, tacking on to that this is as much Ethelbert's book as it is mine, because I was responding to his questions. The book would not exist. As it is, 672 pages, if Ethelbert hadn't conceived the idea and then for a year read just about everything he could that I'd written and published. So this is as much Ethelbert's as it is mine. But I want to say something, because Ethelbert is saying what we need is ideas, right? Well, Congressman Lewis not only said, echoing King, that nonviolence was intended to be a way of life and not just a strategy during demonstrations, he also said, what we need in the black community right now is a revolution in ideas, and a revolution in values. That's Congressman John Lewis, which is why I have such respect for him.
Well, I just want to say
amen to that.
Amen to that. And I just want to say amen to both of you and thank both of you, Ethelbert Miller and Charles Johnson, for putting this work together, the words and wisdoms of Charles Johnson. And I really look forward to our continuing conversations around this book and ideas together over the coming months. Thank you both so much for this hour.
Okay, thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Ethelbert.
Take care. Okay, take care, Charles. Bye-bye.
Uh-huh.
When we come back, it's a brand new episode of Soundbites, our weekly look at food, agriculture, and the environment here on The Mark Steiner Show. We discuss the important role that food policy councils are playing in the state and across the country. And look, the Poultry Litter Management Act and the Farmers' Rights Bill that are being introduced in the state legislature. On our way to break, I want to remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org. is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner.